Hello, this is Julia Shopik. I want to welcome you to the fourth in Keeper.com's audio interview series. Our guest today is Deborah Lynn Dadd, whom the New York Times has called the Queen of Green. Deborah got this unofficial title because of her vast knowledge about which products are and are not green. It is Deborah's passion and dedication to teaching us about the importance of using products that are safe and healthy that has led her to create her information-packed website, www.dld123.com. This passion has also led her to write 7 books, including Home Safe Home and her most recent book, Really Green. She wrote Really Green to answer one of the questions people most often ask her. How do I know if this product is really green? Deborah first became interested in the safety of the products we use almost 30 years ago when she discovered that she herself was suffering from multiple chemical sensitivities that were caused by exposure to chemicals in her home. Through her research, she was able to cure her environmental illness and vowed to help others do the same. As well as being an author, Deborah is a consumer advocate who consults to companies to help them create products that are safer and greener. She also consults to individuals to help them discover which chemicals are causing their problems and to find safer products that they can substitute. One of the first to write about the environmental effects of consumer products, Deborah is also a frequent speaker on the topic and has appeared on numerous television and radio programs nationwide. Today, I'll be talking with Deborah about topics relating to 2 of her books, Home Safe Home and Really Green. We'll talk about how to distinguish between safe versus toxic products, and also how to tell the difference between products that are green and those that aren't. We'll also discuss how to identify the degrees of greenness in the products we buy. Deborah, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Keeper.com. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I thought we would start with your telling about the experience that started it all, that got you interested in the whole idea of the environment and chemical sensitivities. You had your own environmental illness at one point, and you actually solved it way before it was a hot topic. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it was when I was in my early 20s, and I first noticed that I was just feeling tired and irritable and depressed, and I seemed to be having a lot of symptoms that were unrelated, such as I would get headaches when I wore perfume, I would feel faint when I went in the shower, I would have insomnia, and I couldn't figure this out. And my father actually discovered about chemical sensitivities and environmental illness when he was taking my mother for some pretty radical treatments at the time because she had cancer. And so he went in, and he, at the time, they were doing something called provocative neutralization testing, which they still do, in which they give individuals a small amount of a chemical substance, and it turns on their symptoms. And so he would watch while he was waiting for my mother as people were tested, and they'd get a little bit of formaldehyde or something, and they'd burst into tears, and then they'd get a little bit of phenol, and they'd get a really bad headache. And he was watching these people being tested, and he's going, this is what's wrong with my daughter, because he would see me just snap into having some kind of reaction without any provocation that he could see. And so he came home and he told me about it, and he had me read a book about it that was popular then. And he told me about food allergies, which I'd never heard of. And so I went and I found out a little bit about it, and I wasn't tested, but I thought it would be a good idea for me to go on a fast and find out what were my food allergies. And I went on a fast for 5 days. And I drank nothing but bottled water, and at the end of those 5 days, I felt better than I had ever felt in my life. And I said, there's something to this. And once my body was so cleaned out from not having the foods that I was reacting to, I started being able to see very clearly. When I took a shower, I felt faint. When I put on my perfume, I had a headache. I wasn't sleeping at night. And as I was able to identify the individual symptoms, I then said, okay, if these are related to chemicals, then I could look up and find out what kind of chemicals are in these different products, which is exactly what I did. I found out that formaldehyde, for example, is the chemical in the resin that's used to make permanent press bed sheets, and that formaldehyde, you can look it up in a toxicology book, is related to insomnia. And so when I took the permanent press sheets off my bed and put on untreated cotton sheets, which were very, very, very difficult to find in 1980, then I could sleep at night. And I started doing this one by one with each of my symptoms, tracking down what was the chemical that was causing it. And then I'd look it up in a toxicology book. And sure enough, those chemicals were related to the exact symptoms I was having. And as I removed those chemicals from my home, my health returned. And it was very, very clear cut. And it was so dramatic to me that I said, you know what? Here, I can see that all these people are taking drugs for sleep because they can't sleep. All they need to do is change their sheets. All these people are taking all these drugs for their headaches. All they need to do is stop wearing perfume. And I figured that if I could tell people, it would make sense to them and they would change their lives before they got the damage to their body that I got. And they wouldn't have to go through the recovery. They could just be well.
How did you start? So you had a light bulb moment, but it really was almost like a flicker coming in different degrees. Oh my goodness, this causes this, this causes this. What were people's reactions when you started to tell them about this? Your father, I'm sure, was pretty open or very open. How about
other
people?
Well, my father was very open, but I want to tell you there was a light bulb moment where it became really real to me. And that was that one of my symptoms was depression, and I couldn't really identify it because I had a reason to be depressed. My mother had just died of cancer when I really got to the point where I felt like I was disabled. My mother had just died. I had a lot of stress. A death of a parent is a big life stress.
Sure.
And I thought, well, I'm crying all the time because my mother died.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say multiple chemical sensitivities, what that means biologically in your body is that it's a certain type of immune system damage. And my father found out that if somebody who has this type of immune system damage is having a reaction because of a chemical exposure, you can give that person Alka-Seltzer in the gold package, and it will stop the reaction. And there was one night where I was crying and crying and crying and screaming, and I was hysterical. And my father got some Alka-Seltzer in the gold package, and he put it in a glass, and he says, here, take this. And I said, I will not take this, and I threw it against the wall. And the glass broke, and Alka-Seltzer went all over the place. And I later learned that that kind of, no, I'm not going to help myself, was a chemical reaction. Then he very calmly went and got another glass, put more Alka-Seltzer gold in it, and wrestled me to the floor, held my nose, got my mouth open, and put it down my throat. And in 10 seconds, my feelings stopped. My feelings of depression, my crying, everything stopped. And I went, oh, my God. It's not me. I'm not depressed. I'm not hysterical. It's a chemical reaction. And at that moment, I said, I have to find out about this.
So that happened before you actually went and started looking at all the chemicals in your home?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And how did he know about Alka-Seltzer Gold? And why doesn't that company advertise it for that?
He knew it because he had been in the doctor's office and had been talking to these people who were chemically sensitive, and this was the thing that everybody did to stop their reactions. And so he very dramatically showed me that this was what was going on with my body. And up until that point, it had never occurred to me that there were toxic chemicals in my environment. I just kind of had this assumption that I lived in America, we had government, and that those agencies were protecting me and that everything was safe. I really thought everything was safe. I didn't pay any attention to those labels on the cleaning products or on the pesticides because I figured they wouldn't sell it if it wasn't safe. So this was a huge reorientation for me to understand that there are toxic chemicals in the products that we're using every day that are on the shelves in our average American stores, and they're making us sick in everyday ways that we think are something else, and that we're taking drugs for those things when we could be solving so many health problems simply by removing the toxic chemicals from our home. Just last year, I spoke at a conference in Canada about cancer, And they were saying that 75 to 80%, some huge number like that, of all cancers are related to exposure to environmental chemicals.
And in many cases, the agencies, of course, the companies that produce them are saying, we have no proof, we have no proof. More studies. And
things like that, yes.
But this leads me to ask, do you think that the companies that make these products, they have to know they're harmful, don't you think?
I would say in this day and age, they would have to know that, or they've got their head in the sand, because there's so much evidence. There's a really excellent book called, I think it's called The Fluoride Deception. It gives the whole history of how they knew, like back in the 40s or something, that fluoride was toxic. And there was all this evidence over and over and over and over, and yet still today, people want to put fluoride in the water, and citizens have to fight to keep this poison out of the municipal tap water.
Yep.
And they have known for decades how toxic it is, and they still put it in toothpaste. There's so much evidence. And so I don't think it's a matter of there needs to be more evidence. The only thing that I can come up with as to why people continue to do it is economics, and because they're allowed to get away with it. But that said, each of us individually can choose as consumers to not use those products that have toxic chemicals in them, because now more than ever, there are so many products available that are not toxic. That wasn't the case when I first became ill in the early 1980s.
I am so impressed with the way you came upon this, because what I'm doing is picturing when all this happened, and I'm thinking around to people I knew 25, 30, 35 years ago, and they would have looked at you probably, and let's just put it this way, not been very encouraging of your research and what you were finding, because most people did believe that these products were safe, didn't they?
Well, better living through chemistry, you know.
You know, I interviewed Liz Armstrong, who I know you know. She is the author of another wonderful book, Cancer 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic. And I interviewed her for Keeper.com also, and she was talking about how better living through chemistry was kind of like the death knell. People really were believing that all of these chemicals were healthy for us.
One of the things that I'm finding is that after many, many years and hours and hours and hours of research, is that the standard way that we think of things in this country at this time bears no relation to what life is actually like. And that there was a point, I mean, I started out with the toxic chemicals, but then I got to a point where I had an epiphany and I realized that it wasn't just about what was in my house, of taking the toxic chemicals out of my house, that I was actually interconnected with all of life, that there is a web of life, and that if I wanted to breathe clean air, the air outside had to be clean. If I wanted to drink clean water, then it had to be clean water out in the ecosystem. And I'm mentioning this because most people haven't a clue. I don't want to sound like I'm putting people down, but what's commonly promoted in this country and in industrialized nations is an industrialized view of the world, which basically says we can pillage and destroy anything we want and make it as toxic as we want, as long as we make money for our shareholders. And it sounds drastic, but that's really what's going on, is that people are saying we have to make the most money. And in fact, legally, they have a fiduciary responsibility. It's kind of a strange system, but it's not based in nature and it's not based in life. And so people don't even know to like look at toxic chemicals and say, are they harmful to us? It's like, I think that a lot of people like might read that warning label and not even get it. Like I used to not get it, that when it says this is toxic, I didn't know what that meant. I knew what the word toxic meant, but I didn't have a conceptual reality on it until I got so sick and I said, oh yeah, these are really, it's like you don't know that your hand is going to burn until you stick it in the fire.
Right.
Someone can tell you over and over again, but you don't know. And most people don't know the consequences of toxic chemicals until they experience.
And also, you brought up a really good point in one of our previous conversations. When something has a skull and crossbones on the label and says toxic if swallowed, say it says that, people don't think that it must. We have other pores as well. not only, mm-hmm. you know, other openings, not only our mouths, but if it gets on the skin, it couldn't be doing us any good. And in our pores. So I think you're right that there is a disconnect. Industry is good, therefore they wouldn't hurt us.
They have trained us through advertising to believe that.
And have you noticed, since you and I've been talking, I've been watching the commercials, which I usually zip right through with the forward button. But
I do too.
Have you noticed, well, I guess maybe you haven't noticed if you don't watch commercials, but most of the commercials are for things that are harmful to us.
I just want to interject here. There's so many drug commercials, and I won't even name them, but they're all like very light and people walking through meadows and, you know, stuff like that. And they've got these classy little names for these drugs, and they tell you that your symptoms are going to get better. And, then they say, of course, it can cause liver damage and excessive bleeding and death. And they're required by law to read you all this stuff, but they say it so, and it can cause liver damage and death. Like, you shouldn't even be concerned about this because it's all in the same lighthearted tone.
You're right.
And people are hearing this, and they're buying these drugs by the ton. It's like it's not even registering to people that these are toxic and harmful to health.
And even though it says it's toxic, and death and liver damage. I find it amazing. I really, really do. I totally agree with you on that. Before we start talking about really greens, I think our listeners would like to know about how to find these natural alternatives. Say you don't have a lot of money. And I know that if you go to Whole Foods, you can find the non-toxic versions, varieties of products. But I found one of the most interesting things about Home Safe Home that you talked about was the fact that basically there are 5 products that if you get them, you can use combinations of them. And I believe you said they were borax, baking soda, vinegar, salt, and Bonami. And I was like, oh, my God, you can really use combinations of these and do wonderful cleaning and not have toxicity. Is this true?
This is true. And I would like to say that not everything that's natural and non-toxic is more expensive. Because if you were to tally up how much you would spend buying commercial cleaning products and then how much you would spend buying baking soda and vinegar and Bonami, I spend very little on cleaning products. And certainly you can get some very green cleaning products that cost a lot of money, but they're not necessary. And I'm not saying don't buy them. I'm just saying they're not necessary. And something like Dr. Bronner's liquid soap, I use that too. I mean, it's even organic liquid soap. They made it with organically grown oils. And it's very inexpensive. So you don't have to spend more to be non-toxic. In fact, in a lot of ways, you're going to end up spending less.
And also, you introduced me to a product that is amazing. It's called Maggie's Soap Nut.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes. How does that work? I used it at your suggestion, and of course it is just as cost effective as other products, but tell about that.
Well, soap nuts are, they're actually a nut off of a tree that is grown in the southeast somewhere of the world, over in those eastern parts. And when you put it in water, it releases some substance that acts as a soap. Now, these are nuts. I mean, they've just got little natural little wrapping on it, you know, that just kind of flakes off, and there's a hard center, and it's like a nut. And you put them in a little cotton bag, and you put that little cotton bag in with your wash, and not only does the dirt come out, and everything is clean and fresh, but there's no fragrance. This is a completely unrefined, this is as natural as you can get. This goes from the tree into the box. It is not processed in any way. And you put it in with your wash, it gets your clothes clean, and they come out, don't your clothes come out softer than you've ever experienced clothing?
It is amazing. And
yeah.
People who know me know that I don't get into products that much, but I'm a big fan of these. I've been turning loads of people onto it. They come out soft. They come out so that they don't smell that yucky smell.
They're soft against your skin, so there's, like, a lot of people get rashes from detergent.
Yes.
And there's no detergent rash. It
nope.
feels really good. Your clothes feel so good. And when you lie on the sheets in your bed, they just feel so soft. And I'm just really amazed. I grew up in Northern California where there's a plant called soap root. And the Indians used to use it. They'd dig up the plant, then they'd use the root like a bar of soap.
Ooh.
And so when I heard about soap nuts, I was already familiar with the concept that there could be soapy plants. So this was really exciting to me.
Well, I just want you to know that thanks to you, I called the company, and they're coming out with a liquid version. And
mm-hmm.
we're going to look into advising people to use it for washing the Keeper, the menstrual cup that Keeper.com Inc. makes.
And people can make their own liquid, too. There's a recipe on their website, on Maggie's website, about how you can just boil the soap nuts and make a liquid cleanser.
I was going to do that, but I figured as long as they're coming out with a liquid, it probably would be better than telling people to boil it.
I just think that it depends on one's viewpoint, because I do know that a lot of people like doing things like making their own window cleaner. Like, I make my own window cleaner by mixing vinegar and water. And interestingly, a major window cleaner company has just come out with vinegar window cleaner. It's just basically vinegar and water plus some other stuff.
Of course.
And it's just so easy to just, like, mix the vinegar and water, and cheaper, and you can keep putting it in the same plastic bottle. So there are some people who do like to do it themselves, and there are other people who like to buy it. So it's good that both options are available.
I know, and you mentioned about using the same bottle over and over, and you're leading into really green in
mm-hmm.
that when we talk about that, we are a disposable society.
Yes.
I just read an article that it started with the inventor King Gillette, who invented the razor, and
mm-hmm.
the story is in the current Wired magazine, if anybody wants to check it out. But basically, that, of course, inventing disposables is the secret to a good business model. Because what kind of business model is it if you can use something for 30 years before you need a new one, or 10 years or whatever? You know, the Keeper, for instance, can last up to 10 years. This is not a disposable product.
But you can have a viable business selling the Keeper.
Absolutely.
Absolutely,
but it's not a lot
yeah,
of repeat
yeah, yeah.
business with the same person.
No,
the point
it's
that,
not a lot of repeat business.
The point that I'm really getting into, and thank you for leading into it that way about talking about the reusable, is that we also, you pointed out when you were talking earlier, that you began to see the connection between harming our bodies or helping them and that we're connected to the environment. And
mm-hmm.
that's where I believe you got into the idea of really green.
Yes, and it actually took me a good 20 years. It was 1987 when I had this epiphany about the environment and I started studying nature. Because when I decided that I had to live in a way that was more responsible for the environment, I said, well, where am I going to get information on how to do that? And this was 1987, and there wasn't a lot of information at that time. And so I said, well, I just need to figure out this out myself. And I just had one of those intuitive moments where I realized that all of life around me is operating in a renewable and harmonious way. And we don't see other species harming the environment to the point where the planet is in jeopardy. And so I thought, you know what? Life must know something that I don't know. And I just started studying nature. I didn't, like, go to an environmental group and ask them what to do. I started studying nature. And it really took me 20 years of observation and study and asking myself deeper and deeper questions and really being able to see what's there in order to be able to write Really Green. And I really had a lot of realizations while I was writing it. Also, in terms of being able to look at green products from a different viewpoint. And it's like, I think that most people have a viewpoint. And when I use that word viewpoint, I want to be really clear because it's so clear in my mind. A viewpoint is like if you're standing on top of a mountain, you see the world differently if you're looking down at the valley than if you're standing in the valley and looking up to the top of the mountain. And so when I say I'm having a different viewpoint, it's like I'm looking from at this whole thing like I'm standing on top of the mountain. And so I'm seeing it not from being enmeshed in it, mm-hmm. but seeing it from a different angle. And in doing that, I was able to like step out of the whole field of green products and say, okay, I'm going to be a being of nature now. And what would it be like if I, as Mother Nature, were to create a green product? And that's the way I looked at it in writing Really Green. And part of Really Green, I was able to see that there's actually a line of demarcation. And above the line, there are things that we can do that benefit our health and all of life. And below the line, there are things that harm life and our health. And we haven't been looking, as a culture, we haven't been looking at it from that viewpoint. But that's really what we need to do, because it's like we look at it from, like, we're way down on the scale of things being toxic. So if we make it a little less toxic, we're improving. But what we really need to do is make this quantum leap into knowing what are those actions we can take that benefit life and do those, not just a little bit better so we're doing less harm. We need to actually be doing good. And it's a big shift, but it's one that needs to be known and one that needs to be talked about.
It's a huge shift. Probably, I have to admit, by the way, I'm going to encourage people to get your book Really Green, and they have to go to your website, DLD123, in order to get it, I believe. But the thing about it is, now you have to realize, you pointed out, this is the first book that actually discusses this in the way that you came to via your second epiphany. And I really would like to tell you that it was eye-opening, but also there is a complexity to it. For instance, in doing a little bit of research, I found some of the promotional materials about the book that the 18 basic principles that define what's green. Well, there's a lot. And then the 5 basic types of green products, which we can discuss. But give us examples of how you would look at a few different products and apply these conditions to them, or if you'd rather talk about the different categories, conditions, et cetera, that would be great too. You're talking about making a paradigm shift.
It is a paradigm shift. It absolutely is a paradigm shift. But while I was writing this, I was actually in San Francisco on kind of a retreat and not in my normal life while I was writing this, so I wasn't being distracted by my husband or anything like that. And I would just like sit there. And I would look at this, and I would go, oh, my God, I see it differently. I see it differently. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a matter of me just taking all the information and being a reporter. It was like I was really like in a completely different space when I was writing this. And so I'd like to look at it from a product viewpoint. And so in the book, I talk about what the 18 different principles are so that you can understand each one and see if those principles exist in a product. So let's just take a product like you need to make a decision between using paper towels versus a cotton towel. And there is actually a continuum of choices. And so the worst choice would be to use a bleached paper towel because it is disposable and it uses chlorine bleach, which creates dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals on the earth. So if you wanted to do something a little bit better, you could get an unbleached paper towel, which at least wouldn't have the dioxin, but it's still a disposable product. So then the next best thing would be to get a cotton, reusable cotton or linen or hemp. I think they make hemp towels, bamboo, any of those natural fiber towels, because you can reuse and reuse and reuse that towel so many times. I figured out that you could, over the life of a cotton towel, you could probably save hundreds of dollars from not buying paper towels for the number of uses you can get out of one cotton towel. And so then if you wanted to do even better, you could get a cotton towel that's made out of organically grown fat fibers, because most fibers, even natural ones, well, the natural fibers, have a tremendous amount of pesticides in their growing the cotton or the linen. Actually, linen doesn't have so many. Cotton has the most. And even if they're not present in the fabric. They're still in the environment, and you're still getting them. You're getting them in the air and in the water and in the soil. And so we have this whole range of choices that go from the very worst to the very best. And what I'm trying to do is get people to understand that they have a range of choices, and also to recognize at this point in time, you know how when a subject is new, it can be a little confusing, and then after you learn the subject, it just becomes second nature. Like if you've ever learned to play the piano or something,
yep.
It's strange at the beginning, and then you can sit down and just play it. It's like for me at this point in my life, I don't sit there and even think about it. When I see a new product, it's like the thought process goes by in a split second, and I just go, oh, this organic cotton one, that's the one. It's just, I know what it all is. And what I was trying to do was download, for lack of a better term, everything that I know, everything that I think in terms of evaluating products that I've come to after 20 years of study.
And I don't know where I read this. Oh, I do. It was on your website where it talked about the product being your book. And
mm-hmm.
you talked about finding even a green printer. Now,
yes.
I know that people don't think about this kind of thing. We even buy things like copy machines. The obsolescence is guaranteed. They only want
yes.
these things
yes.
to last a few years. Tell
yes.
me about the green printer. I was fascinated by all the details that went into choosing it. Them, him.
Well, it was interesting. There's a certain thing called a colophon, which is something that most people don't know. But what it is traditionally is the printer describing what went into the making of the book. And so I have at the end of my book a green colophon. And I wanted to make sure that the book itself embodied the highest principles that are discussed in the book. And I actually found a printer who does what's called print on demand. And one of the things that most people don't realize is that traditionally in the publishing industry, they print thousands of books. And I think I read a statistic that like half of them just get destroyed. That's a tremendous waste right there. And so I only print them up in very small batches. But this new technology now, print on demand, allows you to print them in small batches at a very similar price as you would have to pay to print thousands of them on a big press. So first of all, I've chosen that technology. And then the technology itself, the machine that they're printed on, all the parts can be recycled. It uses a non-toxic dry ink, so there's no solvents. The paper for the pages and the cover are all 100% post-consumer recycled paper. And this printer uses wind energy. And I was even able to calculate with them how much energy was used to print the book. And I was just so pleased with all of this because it all came together. And even as I wrote it, I said, and when you're done with this book, you can put it in a compost pile, you can recycle it and give it to a friend. Before you put it in the compost pile, you know, make sure that everybody that could possibly read it reads it. And so I was just going through the whole thing, applying all the principles in the book to this book. I was so pleased with that, too. I would like to see that on every product.
Would you like to give the name of this print-on-demand printer?
They're called No Waste Publishing.
No Waste Publishing. Because I think, you know, a lot of people out there, everybody thinks about, oh, I'm going to publish a book someday, and they don't think about the waste. They always have grand ideas, but half of them will be in the landfill, and that's a sad thing.
It is a sad thing, and they just rip the covers off, and they just toss them out. It would be better to just give the books away
mm-hmm.
than to throw them away. Put them in libraries. Have them be of use. Sell them for a penny, whatever. Don't just throw them away. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that all these resources, people talk about them as natural resources as if they're not living things. But in order to print a book, you're taking a tree. That's a living thing. And to me, if you're going to take the life of something so that life can persist, because I know there's a point of view that says we shouldn't be killing anything, but that's just unrealistic because everything is, it's like all these life forms are exchanging the life forms to support other life forms. That's just the way it is. And it was fascinating to me when I learned that there are little microorganisms that are actually feeding on my body. And I don't want this to sound morbid, what I'm about to say, but it's like if you think about if we were in a natural kind of situation, like if we were native peoples living out on the land, when they died, they just went and laid their body on the earth. They didn't have any formaldehyde preservatives. They didn't have any caskets, nothing. They just laid their bodies on the earth, and other life forms feasted on the body. And so the idea of life just perpetuating itself by exchanging these life forms, giving light into life form, it's all a perpetual cycle. And if we're going to take a living life form and use it as a resource for us, I think there should be a purpose, and that we should honor it, and that we should be grateful for it, and that we should actually put that material to good use. And to me, if you're taking trees and then you're throwing the books away, that's disrespect for life.
And it definitely is. And I just think if we could get one huge message out to people, one, of course, would be about the chemicals, but another would be about just disposing of things.
If the only thing that people did was starting using reusable products instead of disposable products, we would make such a huge difference on the planet. It would be remarkable. Something that most people don't know, but is a fact in the book, is that for every pound of product, there's 25 pounds of garbage created.
Now explain that.
Because when you make a product, then garbage gets created in the manufacture. For example, if you're cutting out a dress, there's going to be scrap left over. And when they make a book, for example, they print it and they bind it and then they cut off all the edges. And so all that stuff that's left over from the making of the product is a pile that is 25 pounds for every pound of product that you actually use. I've got a pen in my hand. What is that? Let's say this is a 1 ounce pen. There's 25 ounces of garbage that is packed onto this pen. And if you can just imagine that, everything that you have in your life, there's 25 times that amount of garbage. And so the ratio of waste to actual product is like 25 to 1. And so if you were to use one paper towel versus one reusable towel, each one of them has 25 pounds of garbage. And then if you use another paper towel, you now have 50 pounds of garbage, but you still only have 25 pounds with a reusable towel, you see?
Yes, I do, and this is fabulous.
You know that book about where somebody, Cynthia Stout, or somebody forgot, that refused to take the garbage out, and it just, like, the garbage piles up and piles up. You know that poem?
No.
And you just go page after page, and the pile of
garbage
gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Except this,
I forgot who the author was, but this is what I think of, is that if you were to have a video of how much garbage gets created every time you use a paper towel versus a cotton towel, the pile of garbage would get higher and higher every time you use a paper towel.
So let's put a joint video on YouTube together.
That'd be great.
Because we're both proponents of reusable and not throwing away. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be a fabulous
mm-hmm.
joint
mm-hmm.
project?
It would.
This is fascinating. I'd also like to discuss the deception that companies use. They greenwash things. Can you explain that? They try mm-hmm. to fool us, right?
Well, yes. Now, I've been observing greenwashing for a good 17 years now. It actually started in 1990 with Earth Day, and there was a lot of greenwashing in the early 90s, and then it kind of tapered off, but now it's back. Every time there's a surge of interest in the environment and people wanting to do the right thing, there are unscrupulous people who say, I'm going to jump on this, I'm going to make my product look green so that people will buy it because that's where the market is. And so it's just for people to be aware that that's going on, because there are, in the same marketplace, people who really are making really green products. And so some of the things that people can watch out for, I actually list them all in the book, but one of the major things that's easy to remember is that if somebody just says recycled on their product and nothing else, or they say eco-friendly and nothing else, then watch out for those, because I found that the most green products give you a lot of information. Like, I buy copy paper for my printer at Staples, and it's 100% post-consumer recycled waste. And they have some that are different percentages, and they tell you if it's post-consumer or pre-consumer and what the percentage is. And you know, when you see a label like that, you know that that's really what's in it. But if it just says recycled and it doesn't give any more information, that's when you should start asking questions.
So this is also like in product. If they, you and I have discussed this, if they just say contains and give a few ingredients, there's most probably or possibly a lot of not-so-great ingredients as well.
Yes, one thing I would like to change about the world, and that is to make it be law that you have to list every single ingredient that's in the product. And so some of the most toxic products, like cleaning products, they don't have to list their ingredients at all.
Amazing.
And there is a law that they have to produce something called the Material Safety Data Sheet, which only has to list what the government considers to be hazardous ingredients. And now, a lot of times they don't include things that I consider to be hazardous ingredients. And so it's not a complete list. And another thing that's related to this is that if you were to go into a store and there were two jars of applesauce on the shelf, and one of them says apples and water, and the other one says organically grown apples and filtered water. Now, I think it's very interesting that the one that's got the toxic stuff in it doesn't have to say apples, toxic pesticides, paraffin wax, chlorine, fluoride, etc. But the one that doesn't have those things is the one that has to be labeled. And there's so many regulations about labeling it to say that it doesn't have stuff in it. And the ones that are toxic don't have to say. Now, don't you think that's a little backwards?
I think that's very backwards.
Because the organic one should say apples and water, and the other one should say apples and pesticides.
Apples and pesticides, and there could be lots of other things there. Chemicals in the fertilizers, this kind of thing as well.
I have just been researching something lately that I'd like to interject here because it made such an impression on me. I've just been reading a book called The Body Restoration Plan. And this is written by an MD, Dr. Paula Bale Hamilton. And it came out maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And it's not selling as widely as I would like to see it sell because she has done an incredible amount of research making a connection between pesticides and weight gain.
Mm.
And so she's saying in her book that it's not about eating less food, it's about eating less chemicals. And she goes throughout the whole book and explains exactly how these chemicals that are in food disrupt what she calls the body's slimming system, which is composed of your nerves in your brain and hormones and all kinds of things. And what really struck me while I was reading this is that the number one thing that she identifies from scientific studies is the number one thing that affects weight is pesticides, organochloric pesticides and other pesticides. And these are in any food. Any food, I'm going to say this again, any food that is not organic is making us fat. Prior to this, it was like I was like kind of on this little thing of I'm going to eat as much organic food as I can afford, as I can find. And I knew that there were pesticides in the rest of the food, but it's like, you know, if I'm eating 70-80% organic, I think that's pretty good in comparison to not eating organic at all. But if you look at it from the other direction and say, unless we're eating 100% organic food, anything that's not 100% organic is making us fat and causing harm in our body. That's a completely different way of looking at it, completely.
And it's also being toxic to our bodies.
I mean, it's not just making us fat. It's disrupting our endocrine systems. It's making us depressed. These things affect many, many body systems. I don't want people to think, wow, this is overwhelming. It's taken me 25 years to get to the point where I can say, oh, my God, anything that we're doing is harming us instead of saying, oh, well, maybe I can be a little less toxic. No, it really, we need to make that quantum leap, that paradigm shift that says what we need is we need to have zero tolerance for toxics. There is no need for toxic chemicals in the world. And everything that is less than 100% non-toxic, organic, whatever it is that is the standard for that particular material, is harming our bodies.
Now, what do you do if you're in a climate like where I am, which is right
mm-hmm.
outside of Chicago, Illinois, and you cannot get locally grown foods, so you get an organic food that's from Chile? Isn't that hurting the system with all the travel that the product has to get to us?
Yes. And one of the things that was a revelation for me in writing Really Green was, I'll say it again, this concept of there being this line of demarcation where there's benefits above the line and harm below the line. And so if you're looking at a product like that, then you would say, well, above the line is the benefit of organic, and below the line is the detriment of all of the energy used in shipping and the CO2 that's produced in shipping, which contributes to global warming. So one of the things that at one point made me very depressed for real is that I looked around and I said, I know intellectually what we need to do, but I can't actually get it. It doesn't exist. And what pulled me out of that depression was to say, I know what it is we need to do, and I'm going to work on making that happen. So the reality is that we can't do things 100% right now. But that doesn't mean we can't work towards that, that we can't have that vision, that we can't have that ideal, that we can't be moving things in a direction. I know what the guiding star is now, and I'm moving in that direction, and I'm trying to show it to people and say we can all move in this direction. But I think it's better to go ahead and get the environmentally preferable product from wherever in the world it needs to come, even though it becomes less green every mile it travels from where it is in order to get to you, because it increases the market for it. If somebody in Chile were to make all this organic food and there was no market, they would stop doing it, and they would spray more pesticides, and they would grow something else. And so we want to encourage the market wherever it is, but we need to, again, have a paradigm shift to stop thinking globally and thinking locally, because in terms of food, as you just said, we need to be making sure that food grown close to where it's consumed. We need to be growing food and raising food that is appropriate for the climate. There's lots of foods that can be grown and eaten in the wintertime. I mean, people were living in Chicago before there was refrigeration, before there was industrialization, and they ate food. And
good
there
point.
Are ways to do it.
And before we end, I'd like to bring up another thing, and that is the word natural. How many times is that used and it's fooling us, just like greenwashing? It's used inappropriately. You gave me a wonderful example, and I forget if it was when we were talking or if it was from the book, where you said one great example is, quote, made from coconut oil cut with benzene. That's you're supposed to think that that's natural, correct? Because coconut oil,
yes.
What could be?
the word natural is... what it actually means is that there are no artificial additives, and specifically no artificial colors or flavors or preservatives. It does not mean that it is in its natural state as it is in nature. And it's natural as opposed to man-made. But what really happens is that it used to be in like 100% of the natural cosmetics. They were made from ingredients that were like coconut oil cut with benzene. They're what I called in an earlier book hybrid natural ingredients, because they do come from something like coconut oil, but by the time they get into the shampoo, they're so processed with petrochemicals that a high percentage of it is actually petrochemicals. It's like an apple is natural, but there's so much pesticide on it, it's a high percentage of petrochemicals. And what's really natural is as it appears in nature, but that's not how the word is used in industry.
And one thing that we can do, we were talking about that it's something to look toward and work toward. One thing that we can do is call up the companies if they only say contains and say what else is in there. The more we do that, the more they may just say, oh, my goodness. If they got 100 calls a day, they would start having to list more.
Yes, they would.
And maybe that's what we can do, some activist work here.
I think that there does need to be more activist work. And I remember earlier in my life, like in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot more activism in the consumer world, and there's much, much less now. But I have a blog on my website where people ask questions and air their feelings. And one of the things that happened over Christmas was that a lot of people were buying Martha Stewart's flannel sheets, which when you open the package, they smell like gasoline. And somebody actually did some research and found out that in Pakistan, I think it is, where they were made, they were actually putting kerosene on the sheets. And, I mean, if you go to my website, you can see how outraged people are about this and that they were, like, wanting to do things and write to Martha and everything. Martha actually recalled these sheets.
Good for her.
I don't know if it was because of my readers, but she actually recalled her sheets. And I think that that was a good thing, but it should not have happened in the first place.
Did you put a congratulatory note about Martha Stewart recalling the
No.
See, that's one thing that you should do. She'll notice it. I'm sure she Googles herself. Or has a whole staff Googling her.
Oh, but I'm sure she has a staff Googling her.
But that brings me to one thing before we end. I'd like to promote Deborah's List. And it is a wonderful list, ever-growing, on your website, that lists these natural products. And there's even
yes.
some discussion about which in your newsletter, some discussions about is this really and is there a substitute for it? You're a wonderful resource for people. And what does one have to do to get their products listed on Deborah's List?
They just send me an email and I take a look at them. And I, from my experience, I evaluate whether I think that they are that they qualify for what my standards are, and I do put my standards right on my website. I'm about to, I probably shouldn't say this till I actually do it, but I'm working on actually a system that's based on what I wrote in Really Green that will evaluate products more stringently and more standardly than just my opinion. And you can actually make a picture so you can see visually the relationship between the good of the product and the harm of the product. And I think that when we start using this system and people can enter their information about their products and consumers can look at it and just see a picture of it, then we're going to start to become more aware of that products that we thought were good actually have harm to them. Like one thing that most people don't know is that compact fluorescent light bulbs contain mercury. And mercury is extremely toxic, not only to humans, but to the environment. And it is getting into the ecosystem. In fact, the city of San Francisco has a whole program about making sure that people do not put mercury-containing products like fluorescent lights, compact fluorescents, thermometers, things like that, into the trash because there's too much mercury in San Francisco Bay right now. It's not a future thing. It's right now. And yet people are still, the compact fluorescent bulbs are being promoted as big energy savers without telling people that they need to put them in the hazardous waste. They cannot put it in the trash. And they're also not promoting other energy-saving light bulbs that don't have mercury in them. And I think that when you look in the book, there's an example of that, evaluating in a very simple way of looking at the harm and the good. And there's an example of compact fluorescent bulbs. And you see, well, here's the good, but here's the harm. There's a warning right there. And there is a warning on the label, but it's on the back in very, very tiny print.
When we were talking about it, you said, yeah, that you didn't think they wanted to put that in big print, right?
Well, no, I mean, would you buy a light bulb that says saves energy, and oh, by the way, it's got mercury in it?
No, I don't think I would.
And it has to be disposed of as hazardous waste? Like, how does that make sense?
you know,
it's like the same thing as drug companies promoting these drugs and saying, oh, and it causes liver damage.
But in any case, I remember that example that you gave. And I guess we should also say that as long as it's in your house, it's not dangerous for you. Although you said there are safer alternatives.
There are safer light bulbs, yes.
Yes.
And you're correct. As long as the light bulb is in the socket and it is contained and it's not broken, it's safe for you.
Because you know what? As soon as you told me that, I was going to go up and start taking them out. And you said, no, no, no. It's safe for you. Just make sure that you dispose of it correctly.
And don't let it break.
I would like you to give your email address so that people can write to you about products or questions. And then I'll give your website address, too, before we go.
My email address is Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, at dld123.com. But if you have a question about a product, the place to send that question is to my blog. If you just go to dld123.com, you'll see it's very obvious, the Green Living Q&A blog, that's the place to post the question. If you know of a green product that you would like me to consider, then send me an email.
Well, you are one wealth of not only information, but activism. And that is just an unbeatable combination. I want to thank you so, so much for talking with me today. And we'll be putting the interview on Keeper.com's website. And I'll also be doing very detailed show notes, which will have whatever kinds of things you recommended, the books and all of that, including, of course, your two books and other links that you'd like me to include. So people, if you missed anything and you said, oh, my goodness, they slurred or she slurred or whatever, just go to Keeper.com and we'll have what I think was a terrific interview with Deborah Lynn Dadd. You were a pleasure.
It was my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so, so much.